Anyway, good morning, everybody, and welcome, welcome. We are we're on journey home, and it's Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson, and we are going through the Ken Wapnick book, and it is called The Journey Home. So that makes it easy to remember, unless I'm mistaken, which could be. and as I posted on Facebook, I don't know if you saw this, but I was, when my grandkids were here, I was dancing in my living room, and I have a Fitbit. Sandy got me a Fitbit for Christmas, and so the next day I was looking online at my Fitbit activities, and it said I went for a run. I went for a run, and I ran a half a mile, and I didn't go any distance. Yeah, exactly. So I went 0.0 miles, but the actual, and it showed the, it had a little diagram of all these back and forth and back and forth lines dancing in the living room with my granddaughter. So so you can get home. You're already there. Yeah. So so we are in, again, The Journey Home, The Obstacles to Peace and A Course in Miracles by Dr. Kenneth Wapnick. And we had read this section last week, but we're going to reread it this week because it's kind of the crux of the beginning of the book itself, and it's about the four obstacles to peace. So I think, you know, let's just read and see what has to be said. Do you want to read? Yes. Actually, okay, oh good. for some reason, I don't know what the reason was, but for some reason I was having trouble with the radio getting, oh look, and there, that's way down. And okay, I'm just trying to get our sound up. There we go, so that we can, I can actually record. And that is exactly, kind of one of those kind of things that if you know, if I were not so intent on having a certain outcome, then I would have been listening fully to what you were reading and commenting on, and that's kind of an indication that, I mean, right off the bat, I put this thing here that said, oh, I'm not getting good sound on the radio, and therefore I must do something to fix it, and I go into all my little obfuscations trying to repair what really wasn't broken at all, because as soon as you stopped reading and asked me if I had any comment, everything started working. So...
loss of its individuality, which requires a non-existent defense, sin, guilt, and fear, which then itself becomes another non-existent problem, in parentheses, God's wrath, and of course it's really the ego's God, because obviously God has no knowledge of this in terms of the course's metaphysics, which is the whole the heart of why A Course in Miracles is A Course in Miracles and not in something else, right? Because it seems miraculous that you know, we're off the hook only from the perspective of the ego. Okay, requiring yet another non-existent defense, the world and the body requiring yet more non-existent defenses known as special relationships to protect our physical and psychological selves. And on and on and on it goes until a whole thought system and world, macrocosmic and microcosmic, are erected, governed by the principle of keeping the Son of God as far away from his mind as possible, so that his thought system can never be changed.
Wow, you know what? Do you watch that show? It's called The Good Place.
Have you seen I've heard of it, but I haven't watched it. So.
Okay, well then I'm not going to spoil it. But I'm going to say that when it comes right down to it, the thing you should watch the show. The thing that's keeping us from heaven is this, all of these complexities that we have put out into our world. And I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, but because it's the truth, is that every single thing that you do in this world, and it's always been this way, it's just a lot more easily seen right now, that everything we do in this world has an effect on every other thing in this world. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, if I decide that I'm going to, go out in my car driveway and turn my car on and let the engine just run and let all the carbon monoxide and gas fumes and everything go out into the air, you know, I can just let my car run for an hour to heat it up, and then I can go drive around and, you know, I can just put all this stuff out into the air. And it doesn't bother me, but, you know, it's adding to all the other stuff everybody else is putting in the air. It's taking fuel from, you know, there are so many complex things that are happening just by my simple desire to have a warm car to ride in to go to work, that I don't recognize that I'm really thinking this. But in part of my mind is this idea that I'm causing suffering, I'm causing pollution, I'm privileged to have this thing, and other people are you know, suffering in the cold. You know, I'm filling my mind with guilty thoughts about my situation that are based on every bit of my trying to be a good person, every bit of my thinking, you know, I don't want to hurt other people. And so all those complex thoughts that are hiding behind this one idea that I want to have a warm car to ride in make a world filled with sorrow and fear and upset. We don't recognize that the innocence of what we are be tainted by all of these complex situations that seem to be occurring because of our behavior and our whatever we're doing. But unless you can walk it back and go back to the beginning of how did this all start, and, you know, why, you know, it is all basically my saying to God, you know, screw you, I want to do it my way. And that's the reason that we are feeling guilty, not because we're taking food from starving children or we're suffocating the oceans or whatever. It's because the initial decision to reject all the goodness that belonged to us made us believe that we're guilty. And so that's all we're doing, is trying to defend ourselves from this God who we think is angry, or who we think blames us. I don't even know if I think God's angry. I probably do, but I just think God blames me for not being good enough because I let all this crap happen.
And if we really, if we watched, I was listening to NPR and several other familiar community radio stations like KPFA and KVMR that I used to listen to in California as I was traveling through California the other day on my way back to Oregon. And I was listening to a really interesting gentleman talking about, who's a mountaineer, talking about how, you know, there's, you know, all the glaciers, the significant glaciers on the planet will be gone within the next 10 to 20 years at the rate that they're receding, and the permafrost melting, and the amount of the heat is being trapped by the ocean due to global climate change and the change in climatic conditions. He was saying that the amount of additional greenhouse gases and the thermal change to the planet was just kind of a shocking statistic that I hadn't heard before. But I remember the number because 97 is not a difficult number to remember. He said that if we didn't have oceans to absorb the amount of heat that's been added by, you know, over the last few decades, that, you know, greenhouse gas, you know, changes, there's a calculation that was done that suggests that the Earth's atmosphere without the oceans would have risen 97 degrees. So I was like, that's a pretty staggering statistic. Obviously, not that we don't have an ocean, because we do have an ocean. So, but that's, you know, we need to be grateful to our oceans, you know, on the level of four. but that's a pretty interesting, you know, numbers. Like, you know, we'd all be basically pretty toasty. So thank you, oceans. You know, let's do what we can, you know, within the world that we live in, to, you know, keep things from deteriorating any more quickly than possible. But the whole point of what we're talking about, Lynn and myself and anybody else on ACM Gather here, is that that sort of behavior that allows us to do, you know, to be kind to our planet, kind to each other, and to do, you know, what we can, is the result of a thought system. And we're most effective at that, ironically, or you know, maybe practically, when we go beyond the thought system of sin, guilt, and fear, and look at the causes in our mind, and do what we can to recall as often as possible that we are not guilty in truth of anything, because we never left that perfect oneness. And the character, the dream characters that we play, really, the behavior of those characters in a dream world, dream characters in a dream world, it doesn't mean that we should stop doing what we're doing if we're environmental activists or political activists or you know, what we can to stop world hunger, or, you know, all the myriad of problems that face us as, you know, humans on a planet that has finite resources and a seemingly closed energy system, but it's really this vastly complex network of cause and effect relationships. And but the important cause and effect relationship that's generally overlooked, that is really pivotally important to the behaviors that then can make a difference in the world, is really the choice in the mind of which thought system. So I had a wonderful conversation with Bob Rosenthal, who's the co-president of Foundation for Inner Peace, along with Tamara Morgan, yesterday, and we were going through his new book, From Nevermind to Evermind, chapter by chapter. So I'll put a link on ACM blog up to that shortly this weekend. But so this first one is, you know, a question of identity, basically, which is what I call the chapter of my second book, and the chapter of his second book is, you are what you seek what you are. And basically, we were both talking about how the most important question any of us can ask is, you know, who am I, which is what the ego's version of it is, or what am I, which is what the Holy Spirit, revises it to let us off the hook in terms of an intractable problem of unresolvable guilt, and this non-existent problem, because the guilt and the sin and the fear and the mortality of this non-existent fraudulent identity is really at the heart of all the things you were talking about, you know, whether it's, you know, warming your car or you know, all the what's in it for me kind of stuff that we might feel bad about, and watching our egos, because that's really the only thought system they have to draw from, and cleverly the ego has made all of these layered defenses, to avoid looking at that. But once we get through those defenses one by one, patiently, typically over a long period of time, we actually are more able to be effective in whatever little ways in the world that we can. But more importantly, we're able to be at peace, which is really affects not just our local environment, but the whole cosmos. I mean, the beyond what we can even imagine, because we're so, you know, plenty of adjectives or prefaces to the word centric, but we're just, you know, how about tiny centric?
Yeah.
We're so focused on the little tiny pinpoint droplet wannabe identity and what happens and befalls to it and those closest droplets to it that we forget the big picture. The big picture is, again, having, you know, study this for a while. We don't really totally get this until really the end of the process, but we get hints that what our real identity is, it's not a who, it's a what, is this one perfect self that appears to have taken the form of these separate thoughts and minds and then personalities that then have bodies that need protection and appear to war with each other and battle over scarce resources and the whole lack and loss paradigm, and you know, it goes on and on, doesn't it?
It does. It goes on and on and on. And something that you said, and it reminded me of something that has been kind of a topic of discussion amongst a few of my folks I chat with, is the idea that it has to take, you know, it took millions of years to get here, and it's going to take millions of years to get back. And Jesus says that salvation is immediate. It's right now. And it's not because I have undone all of the knots that I wove. It's because I've determined, I've decided that I am only going to be informed by God, that I'm not going to listen to the ego thoughts. And it was something in the reading the other day in chapter 4, and I think it was chapter 4, anyway, where Jesus says you can avoid all of those little lessons if you could just accept this one thing. And so he talked about accepting this one thing, which we all, you know, the atonement is the one thing. But what he was talking about, and it was, I think it was in the innocence and the ego or something. Anyway, what he was talking about was accepting your own innocence and the innocence of the world, the innocence of God, the innocence of your brother.
That's it, isn't it?
If I could just accept that they are innocent, that God's innocent. He didn't do anything to me. He didn't try to throw me out of heaven. That was my idea, you know. But I'm not guilty for that either, and no one else is. And so when we're talking about, you know, what are these obstacles to peace, really the big main thing is this belief that we lost our innocence. Mm-hmm. You know, that has not occurred. So shall we read on?
Sure. Yeah, just you know, before we do, I was just thinking, all the figures that are paraded through the media that are targets and played up for, you know, basically the scapegoats for what we think of as our own shortcomings projected out, the whole strategy of the ego is to keep us mindless by furthering the projection, and the projection, you know, typically being, well, there's this person or these persons or you know, whether it's a family member or a politician, whether it's a, you know, a celebrity or a, you know, neighbor, or it doesn't really matter. It's basically a ploy used by the ego to keep us mindless, and that mindlessness as you point out brilliantly, Lynn, is the crux of the whole thing is recognizing the intrinsic innocence of everyone, not on the level of form or behavior, but in terms of spirit and seeing through the form to that essence. And we do that by practicing forgiveness, and that's why A Course in Miracles has such emphasis on relationships, and particularly special relationships, because, you know, we have this what's in it for me, you know, what can I get more of, what can I have less of, be it, addiction aversion dichotomy that the ego is you know steeped in, and if we can just kind of look at that with a little sense of humor and just say, oh, there goes that ego again. I just need to look at that without condemnation, and then get back to that, like you say, instantaneous peace that's possible by accepting the atonement for ourselves by seeing everyone in our lives, no matter who or what, as perfectly innocent in truth. Not necessarily in the dream of space-time as we see it. So should I go on and
sure,
read the next paragraph?
Yeah.
Okay. Working backwards then, we can see that obstacle four, the fear of God, but begins the process of teaching the son that his mind is fearful of the loss of his individual identity, the inevitable result of believing in the reality of sin and guilt. Obstacle three, the attraction of death, proves that indeed we should be afraid of God. His wrath means our certain destruction. This necessitates making a body and world in which to hide. Obstacle two, the body is valuable for what it offers, wherein the body's feelings of pleasure and pain root the son and the belief in its, quote, reality, unquote. Finally, obstacle one, our desire to be rid of peace, expresses our ongoing need to suffer so that someone else will feel guilty. The attraction of guilt, establishing ourselves as innocent victims who are powerless to alter our tragic fate. And then some of the things that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation this morning, Lynn, about the cause and effect relationships, I was thinking, well, we tend to think, well, there's this, you know, these certain things that have made me miserable. You know, we have this goatscape in our mind, as I call it, for scapegoats. And, you know, we tend to focus on just a small number of causal factors, when in fact, even on the level of form, it's an infinitely complex web, including, you know, forces and patterns and things set in motion in other galaxies, you know, as far as we know. How do we know that there aren't other things going on that are influencing us, you know, because of quantum mechanics suggests that, you know, everything is interconnected. So how do we know, you know, what's going to happen next? We really don't. We can make, you know, predictions based on these Newtonian models, and, you know, our weather system is essentially that. But the quantum theory suggests that, you know, anything can happen at any time, so to a certain extent. Now, granted, on a practical level, it's not, you know, something that we would want to, you know, trust in on that level. But it, you know, I think that's was one of the things that quantum mechanics, you know, blows wide open, is the idea that the only way to understand the universe is this billiard ball model. But anyway, it's interesting that, you know, that we describe cause and effect to just such a narrow range of things that are closest to us in our space-time world kind of thing. But again, the desire to be rid of it, of peace, that is, and the need to suffer reminds me of one of the things in Ken Wapnick's commentaries on the Course, where he says, as long as you feel victimized, or if you feel like you're a victimizer at any given moment, you know, it doesn't matter because it's really two sides of the same coin. If those thoughts of victimhood, whether it's recipient or perpetrator, and if you're engaged in that at any given moment, you can pretty much be certain that you're at the bottom rung of the ladder of climbing your way back unchangeable peace kind of thing. Do you want to read the next few paragraphs?
Actually, no, I had something to say about something that you were saying as well. Because, first off, imagination. Okay, you just imagined up a scenario of whatever galaxies and whatever. Recognize that that has been imagined. That was one of the first, that was imagined long, long ago, and all of those things are actually part of the, if you can imagine it, it's here. It was, it's part of the fabric of the dream. Exactly. And as well as every world that you can imagine. So if you can imagine a world where hobbits and elves and those things, that was already written. You know, those every single bit of that was already written and exists at this very moment in the dreamscape. So when you're talking about quantum mechanics and, you know, if things over here are affecting things over here, well, it's all one thing.
Of
course, it's interconnected, every bit of it. And also remembering that the real world that Jesus talks about, where everything sparkles and is, you know, innocent and pure, that is also in this same dreamscape. And it is the only difference between experiencing that part of the dreamscape and experiencing this part of the dreamscape that I seem to be experiencing is my state of mind and my decision to see. So, you know, as I determine more and more to see things differently, to see, as our lessons are telling us right now, you know, not the victim of the world I see, and I've invented the world I see, and all of that stuff, as we begin to see that more and more as our reality and the truth rather than a belief, which is still part of the lessons, as we have to have belief before. And Jesus said, I was a believer first too. So we have to have the belief, but we're moving from belief to knowledge. We're moving from perception to truth. And so, you know, it's upon us to choose what we will perceive. You know, we have a responsibility for sight that, you know, once we start recognizing it, does bring us from that world of fear and into a world where we can actually see innocence. This is the... you know, we're unwinding it all, and you can unwind it all instantly if you could just accept this. Mm-hmm. But that's a big thing. Jesus himself, he said, my final lesson, and it took great willingness and effort, was to hear only one voice. So it's not, I'm going to do that now. It takes great willingness and effort.
It does. And I think, you know, Gary Renard and his teachers say that nicely, where they summarize that by saying he wasn't the ultimate leader, he was the ultimate follower.
Exactly.
And he demonstrated that his willingness to listen to the Holy Spirit was the only thing that mattered. And that kind of ties into the, you know, workbook lessons we just finished. Above all else, I want to see, and I want to see things differently, and that there is another way of looking at the world, and all they all tie together. But but it's that complete commitment that takes a lot of time for most of us to recognize that all of the strategies of the ego that we've attempted haven't worked, and at some point we cross off everything off the ego's bucket list and realize, okay, there's still something missing, like everything, and they would say, hey, maybe if I get nothing, I'll have be restored to the awareness of everything again. And sure enough, that works. But we get little glimpses of it. It's not like it's a sudden thwack, and we're not going to be hurled into reality, as the Course puts it, and we don't need to be afraid of suddenly losing our bearings and having this world disappear. It's typically a pretty gradual process where we become more and more peaceful until, you know, we're comfortable with the idea that well, maybe all the things that I had treasured in the world and valued and esteemed above, you know, in a comparative way, were, not truly serving me or anyone else. And if I can just let go of my attachments to outcomes in the world still do the things that I would have done anyway, but with that little inner smile and just say, okay, the outcome doesn't matter, but the decision-making faculty in my mind matters immensely. And what that decision-making faculty is choosing, and really one of two thought systems at any moment, that's the big binary choice moment to moment, isn't it?
It is. And as Jesus says in the development of trust in the manual for teachers, he says, were not each step in this direction so heavily reinforced, it would be hard indeed.
I love that. That's my favorite part of that whole section, by the way. So that's step five, yeah, which is oftentimes referred to as the dark night of the soul, and I love Kim Wapnick stuff, because that's when we basically, kind of discover that forgiveness works, and gee, if Bruce forgives the things in Bruce's world, that things seem to be getting better, and to a certain extent they do. But there's still this Bruce or this Lynn that's making these decisions, and eventually, this is sort of getting to the more advanced stuff. But we need to go beyond that, those separate identities that seem to be doing the forgiving, in order to really have the peace that is totally unchangeable. Because as long as we're identifying with a separate self that's making those decisions, we're kind of missing the point. And Ken also says that the way to measure it, not that it's about measurement, but if you wanted something to measure your progress in the course, one way to do it is to recognize, to the extent that you recognize that he's not addressing separate selves, but he's addressing the decision-making faculty in the mind, that's a pretty good clue right there that it's really, not about, fixing the dream. It's not about repairing the stuff in space-time, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's easy to confuse that. I was actually just reading an article in Vox, online journal, I guess, about Marianne Williamson's candidacy for president, and I was thinking, well, here's a person who, in addition to myself, has introduced a lot of people to A Course in Miracles with her early work with Oprah Winfrey, and along with Jerry Champolsky and some of the early connections I had to learning about the course in the mid '80s and before, actually. And then I realized, well, there's nothing wrong with doing all those things and fixing up the world, but it's easy to confuse fixing the dream with changing our mind and changing the thought system, if we aren't alert to the level of confusion thing. So I think it'd be cool if Marianne Williamson or somebody like that were president. But I'm also recognizing that as long as I'm dependent on an outcome, whether it's an election on that level or it's just the 24/7 voting that I'm doing for which thought system I'm choosing. That's really more to the point of what A Course in Miracles is talking about. That's the election that we have, 10 to the 44th times per second, perhaps, if it's the Planck time constant that
I think it is.
That strobes our decision making faculty, and which reality we're going to choose. That's a lot of little decisions there.
I just felt myself strobing when you talked about that. So seriously, it's like, oh, you're in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out, and you can't even count it. So that's happening. But the Marianne thing, this is interesting to me. Because obviously that was in the script. She has no more to do with that than you or I. We're not involved in that. That was something that was decided on a long time ago. The only question that we have to ask is, what is the purpose? And not even what's the purpose of that. What's the purpose of me thinking about it? What's the purpose of, what do I intend to happen? What is my thought about this? And
it's our special relationship to everything, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's really
exactly.
At the heart of each moment.
It is, exactly. And so that's all you have to ask is, what does that have to do with me? Mm-hmm. And, once you recognize, well, it really has not a damn thing to do with me. It may have to do, honestly, that's not my business. Is that my business to deal with that? No. My business is between me and God and my brother and seeing that everything here is perfect. If that's what, you know, Jesus is telling me, is that, you know, when you learn to see this, when you learn to see the world as the Christ, you learn to see your brother as I learned to see my brother, you learn to see Marianne as Jesus sees Marianne, you learn to see Donald Trump as Jesus sees Donald Trump. Where is the problem? You know, what? Okay, fine. You know, people do what they do. Am I going to try to change the world? Or am I going to look only for the truth? And if all I care about is finding the truth, then what do I care about who's... If on the level of form, I'm looking at the form and trying to repair it. I'm trying to fix something that, you know, it's like your old car. You know, there's going to be a point at which you say, this thing is no longer fixable. And especially newer cars. Old cars, yeah, you could fix an old 40s car and probably drive it forever. But you're not going to say, oh, my car, I'm just going to leave it now in the driveway for the rest of eternity because it was a good car for me and I don't want to give up. No, give it up. Move on. You don't have to carry those old things with you. There, it's not necessary to fix every old thing. All you have to do is let the Holy Spirit change your mind about it, and it's, you'll see it was perfect all along. Nothing was wrong. I don't know. I'm speaking to fire.
I just had a funny image. This is totally an aside, but I just said, when you talked about getting rid of an old car, I was thinking the future version of that, which isn't perhaps too far off of, since we're already hearing about, so I haven't seen one, but you know, the self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. I can say, well, yeah, this car is infected with malware, and it keeps wanting to drive to the tip of Alaska where a barge is shipping a bunch of them to Russia, you know, because of the hacked operating system of the car, you know, just so they could be exported to Siberia or something. I don't know, just kind of a funny little sci-fi short story thought in my mind.
The car got a mind of its own, or got hatched. You know,
I just very silly.
But when I was talking that, I was remembering how many people do have. I have an old car sitting out in my yard that nobody wants to decide what to do with. So I guess I should talk.
I think that actually kind of addresses another, or brings up another kind of perspective I find helpful, and that is that we don't solve problems on the level of the dream, as Einstein suggested, but we outgrow them by maturing into a different thought system where the problem is rephrased and you know, reconfigured to where it's really the problem of choice of thought systems. And I think that's, again, why, you know, I was referring to, you know, that Bob Rosenthal's You Are What You Seek What You Are chapter, and my Question of Identity, the Two Thought Systems chapter in each of our second books. It's like, well, because that's really the pivotal question, is what of those two thought systems are we going to choose? And we're always going to seek what we think we are, because that's the nature of each thought system. And you know, what Ken talks about it here is what we've been reading this morning, is that those two thought systems, this one of the ego of the two, that one of the ego has this brilliant strategy that is basically all about hiding the power of decision in our mind to choose again for a completely different result, not necessarily in level of form, but a result in our mind in terms of the peacefulness that we have. So.
And you know what's interesting is, as you were saying that, for some reason it popped into my head, the lessons that come up later on in the book, where Jesus says, you know, whenever you have a thought today that upsets you, replace it with this thought. Uh-huh. And he gives you replacement thought, right? And you know what's so crazy? If you do that, it works. And when you recognize that you can replace any one of your thoughts with, I could see peace instead of this, or, you know, I trust my brother who's one with me. If you could just, whatever thought came up in your mind, like, you know, that crooked politician or that politician that was, you know, dressed in blackface or like a KKK member in the past, you know, I could see peace instead of this. I don't have to see a thought or judgment or strategy about that person. This is a replacement of the thought system, because the ego thought system, if you pay attention, you'll notice it has no coherence. It just puts things in. Everything could be going fine, and all of a sudden, ego will put it in a thought, you know, what would happen if, you know, somebody died? Or, you know, what would happen if you got the flu? Or, you know, ego starts putting these thoughts in your mind of, you better do this, or you better not do that, or fear, fear, fear starts coming into your mind. And if every time, and they're random, there's, you know, never a thought in my mind that a person was going to die until that thought popped into my mind. And so, you know, that was the ego inserting something in there to bring about a fear and to distract my attention. But if I just retract my attention mm-hmm. by just remembering, hey, you know, this is bullshit, then sure enough, I stop thinking that thought. It is not a reality, but ego is filled with these savage thoughts that are meant to distress you and to bring about fear. And it just the next time some kind of thought comes into your mind that's a fearful thought, just stop and ask, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll recognize that was not even my own thought.
Right. You said something a moment ago about coherence, and I was thinking that what the ego doesn't have any coherence with is truth. But in itself, it is completely consistent, and I think Ken Wapnick points this out brilliantly, is that the two thought systems that A Course in Miracles addresses, the Holy Spirit and the ego, both are completely consistent within themselves. But the ego is entirely 100% insane, and the Holy Spirit is entirely 100% sane. And because we go back and forth between the two of those, especially once we start, you know, studying and applying A Course in Miracles, or any non-dual metaphysical system for that matter, we observe the ambivalence and the fact that we're still trying to, you know, have our cake and eat it too. We're still trying to make the ego work while going beyond it. And so, you know, it's a serious schizophrenic situation. And I think watching the contents of our mind and noticing the extreme difference in how we feel is at the heart of the strategy of A Course in Miracles, which is, you know, in every paragraph, certainly in every section in the text and the other two books for that matter, there's the contrast between the two thought systems and the results in quality of feeling and thought and experience that we have. And, you know, there's no mince words there and no pussyfooting around. You know, Jesus pretty much lays it out as it is and does it in no uncertain terms. And that's why, you know, sometimes people, when they start reading the Course, like, oh my gosh, you know, is this all the stuff that's going on in my mind? And yeah, I mean, if we start exposing the insanity of the ego and how it is completely insane, you know, the ego loves to hide from that. And so that's why the brilliance of A Course in Miracles is basically in every page to expose and reveal without condemnation the insanity of the ego. And just ask, it keeps asking us repetitively over and over again, like Groundhog Day, it's a little plug for the day we're recording this, to consistently make a habit of choosing against the ego and until we get it right. You know, as Bill Murray's character in the Groundhog Day movie, I finally did by having enough lifetimes, in this case, each one lasting just one day in that story, but, you know, we get as many lifetimes as we need in whatever duration in the dream to go back and keep doing it until we get it right. And I think that's, in a sense, what we are all doing. We're all, you know, looking at the repetitive nature of our choices and seeing how consistently choosing the thought system of kindness and innocence and seeing everyone as innocent brings us peace. And when we choose against that, we are consistently miserable. But we kind of need to see the pattern because we've covered over what's really going on in our mind with so much distraction because the ego really likes to hide. And it's like a little cockroach, you know, don't turn that light on. I want to, you know, scurry around. And as soon as the light comes on, it's like, ooh, let's run for cover here.
Yeah, it does. What you led me to think about when you were talking about this mind watching, this is the lessons. Every lesson, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know, people don't get this, and I read a lot of people say, well, you know, mind watching is the way to do it. Well, just do these lessons every day, and it tells you, you know, watch your mind, think about this thought, and then, you know, for 2 minutes, watch what you're thinking, and you know, compare it to this thought. You know, Jesus is teaching us to watch our minds, and it only took me about 4 times going through the lessons before I began to realize, oh yeah, this is really what he's teaching me, is to watch my thoughts and to question my thoughts and then to see the truth. In every lesson there's a little lesson of truth, and then comparing our thoughts to that lesson of truth. It's beautiful. So I'm going to continue reading. We have about 5 minutes left. Uh-huh. Let's see if we can get through a couple more paragraphs here.
Sure,
We're reading The Journey Home by Dr. Kenneth Lopnick, and it's based on The Obstacles of Peace from A Course in Miracles. Okay, so he's been talking about the insane strategy of the obstacles to peace. And he says, we can summarize this brilliant, though insane strategy on the ego's part in terms of a de-evolution of the son's identity. Did we already read this? I don't think
no,
so.
No.
Okay. It begins, as we saw, on the ontological change, quote unquote, from the non-dualistic self with a capital S of Christ with a capital C to the dualistic decision maker of the separated Son of God, capital Son of God. It metamorphoses then into an individualized son with a capital S, then a sinful, guilty, and fearful one. The process culminates with the making of the world, wherein the son now becomes a body that is the innocent victim of the world around it. The journey from heaven, the descent to the hell of this world, is thus completed. So this is if you wonder, you know, how do we get here? How did I get here?
that was a very abbreviated in one paragraph, epic journey. that, you know, it's really an enormous, you know, ontological trip, you know, if you will, that Ken just, you know, summarized in an incredibly short paragraph. But now he's going to spend the rest of the book going through in much detail. How to undo each of those steps by retracing, you know, going back up the ladder. There's a wonderful audio that Ken does, you know, the ladder of, I forget the name of it, but it has a ladder in it anyway. like a multi-day, academy class kind of thing. I mean, I'll have to read that, listen to that again because it's been a few years, but it's, you know, he kind of goes through all those steps of how we go back up through the ladder. And then in this book he does pretty much the same thing, so.
So very cool.
Yeah.
So that's in a nutshell, if you wonder, that's how we got here. So the next section is called The Undoing of the Ego Through Forgiveness. And I'm going to read the first paragraph. I'm going to read probably a couple, and we'll start back with this again next week.
I think that's a perfect, okay. I was just going to suggest that, yeah.
So I'll read this so we get something to move in on, and then next week we can start from the beginning here.
Uh-huh.
So, the undoing of the ego through forgiveness. Inherent in the four obstacles to peace, again, the ego's defensive strategy to protect its individuality from the decision maker changing its mind, is their own undoing. In chapter 28, Jesus refers to the process whereby the Holy Spirit leads us up the ladder. Separation let us down. And that's in chapter 28, section 2, 9 through 12, and then section 3. This provides us with the context in which to discuss the process of the ego's undoing, which is the simple reversal of the ego's layering, uncovering these layered defenses to what lies beneath them until the final layer is removed, revealing the simple choice for individuality that was the beginning of the dream. The following paragraph, which we shall consider again under the fourth obstacle, nicely summarizes this process of uncovering the layers of the four obstacles until the love that has been concealed is allowed to simply be. And so here is from the Obstacles to Peace. Every obstacle that peace must flow across is surmounted in just the same way. The fear that raised it yields to the love beyond it, and so the fear is gone. And so it is with this. The desire to get rid of peace and drive the Holy Spirit from you fades in the presence of the quiet recognition that you love Him. The exaltation of the body is given up in favor of the Spirit, which you love as you could never love the body. And the appeal of death is lost forever as love's attraction stirs and calls to you. From beyond each of the obstacles to love, love itself has called. And each has been surmounted by the power of the attraction of what lies beyond. Your wanting fear seemed to be holding them in place. Yet when you heard the voice of love beyond them, you answered and they disappeared. And that's from text chapter 19, section 4.
Interesting how he phrases that, like the last sentence in the past tense, like this is already a done deal. Which is basically a reminder that we're already home dreaming of exile, as the curse puts it. But we have a slow and gradual process that appears for us to be that way, so that we can not freak out and panic and just gradually, again, like Groundhog Day, by practicing over and over to forgive ourselves for believing that we could have chosen an insane thought system, and then eventually we realize we never did. And that's all good.
That's all good. All right. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. This is
likewise
a great hour. Sorry about the problems with the sound at first. It turned out that during all the rearrangement of things here, I accidentally turned on the wrong microphone. So it's all working perfectly now.
Great.
Anyway, I'll see you next week. And we'll continue. I'll put a bookmark there. And then right now I'm going to let go of the mic and turn it over to you, Carrie and Iris. This mic is all yours. I don't see Carrie, but he was here. He's in Oregon right now, so he's traveling. Anyway, Iris, this mic is all yours.